Mr. James, Reel 9. Right, Mr. James, continuing talking about the role of the signals platoon, would the two men that were assigned to each company, would they be assigned to the company HQ of the particular rifle company? Would that be their job?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, they would be with the company commander.
Mm-hmm. So communications from below that level would be the responsibility of the company.
That's right. Well, mm-hmm. The officers read away one of the past messages, but they were under the control of the company commander, who would give us priorities for the signals. Mm-hmm. And there were signal pads, the message pads, mm-hmm. and the company commander would usually fill in write a message on the message pad, mm-hmm. and he would state on that message pad the priority. If it's all annoying, well, you know, send us, give it a signal, and they were forever in touch with them, and they preferred to be busy as well, mm-hmm. because it was interesting to them, and the signals chat really on duty is a busy bloke, mm-hmm. usually. Because mm-hmm. they're always in touch, they're always in with not just with the corps, but with the companies as well. Mm-hmm.
So, looking at we looked at the signals platoon photo that you have of 1940, and there's quite a substantial number of men on that photograph. Yeah. Could you just break down the platoon, signals platoon, as you knew it in before pre-Catterick, into would it be divided into sections? Would it be?
Yes. Well, the signalers, I think, in the platoon, although I started off with 60. We finished up and the strength of the signals was about 36 or 30, something mm-hmm. like that, you know. Bearing in mind as well that not only did our signalers maintain communication between companies and battalion quarters, but they were also in communication with brigade signals as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the brigade signalers usually sent a brigade pickup truck with their not regimental signals, but what I call signals chat with the radio to a battalion. Mm-hmm. And so they had a brigade signals, the Royal Signals personnel as well in touch. Mm-hmm. The signalers, as I said, we know they were ATV in headquarters, and if there were two of each company, but I know there's only 10. Mm-hmm. But they performed all sorts of duties mm-hmm. at main line, mm-hmm. repairing lines, relieving each other every mm-hmm. few hours.
Would there be specialists whose job would be to lay the lines, or would everybody need to know?
Everybody would do it. Everybody was trained mm-hmm. to lay the lines.
So everybody was trained for all the special. They were trained for Morse?
Everybody could do each other's job. Mm-hmm. And they were trained in every aspect of signaling as they down the curriculum. Mm-hmm. From A to Z, they were trained to lay line, they were trained to send, they were trained to maintain and replace batteries and all the sort of thing, and check equipment, mm-hmm. and all the sort of thing. And very often, reading and unreading was a big job, so there were quite a lot of chaps involved in laying line, changing line, reading mm-hmm. it in, and all the sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Would you have your own transport? Would it be a truck?
No. They were with companies, and the companies would usually have their, 1500 big truck or something like that. Mm-hmm. But no, they didn't have their own transport. Mm-hmm. Of course, the signal sergeant had a motorbike, and the signal officer had a pickup truck. But those two, everyone would sort of use everything to the full.
Why would you need a motorbike? Why would you need a motorbike?
Well, for dispatch riding purposes and for getting around from one cabin to another.
Yeah. So would the dispatch riders be part of that setup as well?
Well, the dispatch riders in the MT, in the motor transport section, of course. Yeah. I don't know, particularly the one called Pim. He wasn't in signals, but he was in the MT. But he had a motorbike. The dispatch riders in the motor transport section were part of everything. They would be along convoys on the move with the adjutant, receiving his instructions to go up and down and speak to either the sergeant majors or the company commanders, but they were also there as well to deliver messages.
Mm.
And although, as I say, they weren't part of the Assyrian platoon, they certainly did help in delivering messages and all sort of thing. In war, the dispatch riders are very important. And we had chaps who could ride a motorbike.
Mm.
But the only chap in the Sixth Platoon who had a motorbike was a Sixth Sergeant. And that was for his own use. He had to ride a motorbike when one was allotted to me and never ridden a bike for life. I was given 2 days training and was known as a transport officer.
Can you remember who that was?
And that's right, with a 350cc BSA, you know, big motorbike. And we didn't even get issued with a crash helmet in those days in the war. We had our steel helmets, and when I was riding my motorbike on my motorbike or whatever, my steel helmet, the wind would force it behind, it was around my neck. If I'd come off it, I would have been in great danger. Now we know we're educated now, all these years later, that nobody can ride, must ride a push bike without something in the head. In case you come off and it lands on your scalp.
Mm-hmm.
But I often think about that. The dangers that I was riding all around Norfolk on motorbike.
Oh, we'll get to that when we get to Norfolk.
I didn't have a crash helmet.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about having to weed out men for the signals platoon. Do any instances come to mind of why certain recruits just couldn't? You know, obviously you'd pick them as your pool of trainees. Problems that you had with certain recruits. What parts of the signals course couldn't they?
Couldn't pick up the Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easy code to learn, but you've got to have a retentive memory. To learn Morse is a very simple thing. And after all these years, although I haven't sort of sent any Morse for 56 or 60 years, the other day there's a program on the radio, on the television, Inspector Morse. And there's Morse code sounding before, and my wife said, "What's that Morse saying?" And I read it. It was M da 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 Morse, his name. And so the BBC were sort of exploiting that in the book. But instantly, I could recite to you now, I go right through the Morse alphabet from A to Z. You know, after all these years, it's in the brain. It's funny. Part of it eventually, after you've done it for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never learned Morse before I went into the army, before I became a signal.
Mm-hmm.
But some chaps could not pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
They were dyslexic.
Mm-hmm. Were there any characters in the Signals Platoon that spring to mind? Any
there were lots of characters. There were Yorkshiremen especially, who let themselves go, you know. They were all good human characters, but I remember particularly it's the winter, and there's one bloke, he had a letter from his mother, and he opened the letter and says, "Bugger me, snow 3 foot deep in Claude." And of course we all, we never forgot that all those birds are laughing, you see, because they 3 foot deep in prawn, and he was a character, he was full of humour and jokes, and you know.
Yeah.
And the storeman as well was a character, I think it was Braithwaite, but he was Daniel Storeman.
And where was he from?
He was from Yorkshire, somewhere like that.
So he had a little.
But Braithwaite, you know, you just think all the Thwaites they come from that way.
So there's a lot of Yorkshiremen in the platoon.
Oh, there were quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But Braithwaite was a character as well. And I was very glad to have him because he was in charge of the signal source. And if anybody wanted to replace a battery for an R18 set, they'd go to Braithwaite and say, "Duck battery, bring new one." And he'd do that, you see, any sort of issue with rail wheels. And he was in charge of all the stores.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up that job, checking that everything was working and in good repair.
Yeah.
But he was also very technical.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, anything wrong with the number 18 set, he was great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he could, that was in those days as well, no drum systems, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he said, "This is so loud, he's gone." That's what, and they work. So he was worth his weight in gold with him. I was very lucky to have him.
What about Corporal Reynolds? You've mentioned him.
Corporal Reynolds was with me. We were both private soldiers going through the school in Antill. We must have joined on the same day. We were going through the same sort of experiences. But he didn't get his stripe until much later.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the private soldiers signalers as well, from the early days, you know, from the Bedford until Chalk school days, joined us, the signalers. Jock Gray was another one. There's another chap called Hutchins, but Reynolds, Private Reynolds as he was, earned his first stripe because he was diligent. And I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommended him to Lieutenant Gilden to give the stripe and give him a chance. And then he rose to corporal as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a good chap. I got on very well with him. He was full of yarns, jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You
mentioned a man called Copeland that was writing a book off the tape.
That's right. He was another character. He was an affable character. He was keeping a low profile, and then he'd be shy, I think. And you know, I sense this. And so you bring him out and have a chat with him and see him sort of, you know, make life interesting to show him that I was interested in him.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he said, I'm writing a book.
Was he where was he from? Was he a Geordie?
He was from North somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that was interesting to me. A chap like this, so young, was writing a book. Well, I said, about my experiences to, you know, to fill a book. He said, well, I've got a lot of interesting experiences. And he was one of the, I've never forgotten that conversation, you know, when he said that he was writing a book and that he was adding a couple of pages every day, and it was amazing how it mounted up, and he had quite a sheaf of stuff, you know, that he was guarding with his life and putting in his kit bag and every move, you know, and we all knew that he was like that as well. I suppose a bit copy, literally minded, and probably good at writing composition at school, so yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that his army experiences anyway were placing him good.
And this was right in the early days, even it's
yeah, very
in Scotland.
Early days,
yeah.
Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland.
Right, so in late 1940 you're in charge of the Signals Platoon, and then you're posted to Catterick for a course. Could you just talk through when you went to Catterick, and then what happened when you got there? What time was this, do you think?
Right, well, of course, bearing in mind that I thought that I was very privileged to be appointed as a signal sergeant with so many ex-regular soldiers about who had been in the signals in India and who were wearing the flags. I didn't expect that at all. But I suppose the powers that be, supposedly speaking, the responsibility was given to Lieutenant Gilling to pick his men. And he, obviously, sounded and was aware that everybody was there, and as I said, a lot of the old sweats. I said, I'm going to be a signal sergeant, I've got it, it's in the bag for me. With all my experience in India, what do you know about Hedwig? I said, I don't know about Hedwig. I said, I'm not boastful. I said, I'm quite prepared to serve under you if you get it.
Who was this? Who was
well, I forget this chap, but I can see his face now. He was an old beds and hearts sweat. Who had a cunning face. He was an old soldier, and he must have been about 40 at the time. And he had a hooked nose, and he thought that he was going to get it, you see. Well, I mean, I didn't, just went off. And then one day, Lieutenant Gilden said, I've read your book, where you've kept your copious notes, and I'm most impressed with everything. I don't think you've missed anything. I've speed read from A to Z, and it's wonderful. He said, you are going to be my signal sergeant.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to sidetrack a little bit, you'd only joined the army in March 1940.
January
1940. And you had three stripes by the end of the year.
That's right. That's right.
Was that unusual within the battalion?
Very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I never, beyond my wildest dreams, thought that I would do that so quickly. I'd had dreams when I was in lodgings in Rippensworth, suffering penury and near starvation, about joining the army early to get in on the ground floor, knowing there was going to be expansion, and my aim was to become an NCO. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I was a sergeant before I ever went into the army? And beyond my wildest dreams, I went in there, but I was so pleased to initially to be in the army, as I said, the others were crying every night, that I was in God's pocket. I had good food, good clothes, and 40 shillings a week pocket money. I've never had a life. And I was really elated. And my heart was into it, and I loved the job. Mm-hmm. And that signalling as well. Mm-hmm. I was very good in school, you see, I was a grammar school boy. But to leave the barracks the intensive sort of marching and sweating and training and basic training and all the discipline and life in barracks is very hard, because everyone's please get away from the barracks. Mm-hmm. That's when the discipline is there 24 hours a day. And with warrant officers and NCOs everywhere sort of kicking you off for the slightest thing. And there you had to sort of even polish the soles of your boots. But to be away from barracks as well, in that chalk, empty chalk school, in chalk building in Amtill Road, I was back at school. And we had desks, and we had the blackboards, and we had, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you took to that? You took to the whole
absolutely
study?
Well, Corporal Gilmore, the chap who was in charge of us, was very good.
This is going back to the Beds and Arts days.
Yeah. Sorry?
This is going back to Beds and Arts now. We're going back to...
Yeah, let's go back to the...
This is the Beds and Arts. Yeah.
Beds and Arts.
Yeah.
Mm. Corporal Gilmore was very, very good. He was looking as well at your progress, because he wasn't wasting his time. He had any time to get the signals trained and for classification. There was a deadline for classification. Mm-hmm. He had only so many weeks to do it. Mm-hmm. And we were all chosen from the Barrow Square, you know, and luckily we did it ourselves, and we therefore had to prove ourselves. Mm-hmm. And he does immediately out, mm-hmm. back to barracks, I'm sorry, you're no damn good.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that happened to quite a few
always
people.
Always happened.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So moving forward to Catterick, specifically, when did you go there?
So I was informed eventually. Having sort of used my knowledge as an ordinary NCO without having been to Catterick to receive official training as a signal sergeant, and they are known in Catterick as ACAIs. ACAI, AI, signalling phonetics. ACAI, assistant instructors. And the instructors are the ones in Catterick, but all the British Army and the Canadian Army and some French Canadians, the crowd at Catterick is like the League of Nations. Mm-hmm. And the instructors were numerous as well, from all regiments, but they were first class instructors. There was one Welsh Guard sergeant there. He was a marvellous speaker. He was Welsh Guards. But his method of teaching and his diction and his keenness and his enthusiasm rubbed off on everybody. He was marvellous, that Welsh Guard sergeant, I've got his name. And there was another one from the Mumbleshire Regiment as well there. But they were chaps with Glen Garry's, and they were warrant officers with light infantry, sort of, you know. All sorts of regiments were at Catterick teaching signals, but they were on the permanent staff there. From one year to another, they were brilliant and expert. They were really, I mean, you think, when you're classing and listen to them, you had your, they said it once, it was magical, it was perfect. Mm.
So how would they teach you? Would there be a class of how many men would be in a class? When you
how
went
many?
To, yeah.
Oh, we were, I was in a room, and there must have been an ordered regiment, don't forget, and we were all sergeants as well, you see, because we're all going to be in the lines. So, from every regiment of the British Army, I would think in my class alone, at that time, and that course, there must have been about 50. Mm. And we,
right, so you're in the classes at Catterick.
Yes.
And
so you're now being taught the army there. You're the regimental and there's no consequence of they are trained to teach civilians. And of course, I dare say that the Irish Corps are in Bedford. I think it's as far as 80% there, except that they've never had the experience. But anyway, we were taught all the right forms of teaching, controlling the class, and teaching your chaps to learn everything meticulously right, so that, you know, there would be good results in the classifications and a trained army. Everybody in the British Army would know the procedures and the Morse codes and the messages codes and all ink monkeys, as I said, most immediate things like that.
Talk us through the syllabus then, the what you learned as a sight and signaller. You'd already learned Morse.
If you start off learning the Morse code and you're told about
But you did this already at Bedford, what were you learning at Catterick?
At Catterick, it was mainly teaching. It was mainly putting over all that had to be learned in the correct manner and in the correct order, in such a way that you were a trained teacher, which was the difference. You weren't an amateur, as I was before.
So they were really training you to teach the men back at the battalion.
Right, yeah. And the good chaps with good results, incidentally, were bagged as well, or they were looked for by the school or signals, and they were kept back. This is why we have so many representatives there from all the various regiments, among much your regiment, as I've said, in the Welsh Guard. The good chaps that they discovered would be pitched for them as well. Although I never had any aspirations to sort of stay at Catterick, because it was really a rugged place. The memory that will never leave me. We raised for a pint of beer to Darlington in the evenings somewhere into Richmond. But this school, we were in Messini's lines. Messini's was a big battle in France in the First World War, a place called Messini's or Messines. So I call it Messini's, because that's the way they pronounce it in Catholic. We were in Messini's lines. It was a big school. There were many, many sort of departments. But at 5 o'clock, don't forget it was December, at this time, November, December, Jan, but at 5 o'clock, unexpectedly, you were roused and out on parade in the freezing, bitter moor wind to answer a roll call. And although it was dark in winter, and it was freezing water on Brass Mountain, you couldn't sort of say, sir, for anybody else, because I'd empty yours at various intervals as well. You couldn't sort of, but you were caught out if you had a night out on the piles in Darlington or Richmond. And there were many caught out. But we had to go on these snap 5 a.m. parades, and not once. Half a dozen times, I think, during the time I was there.
What would happen if you were caught out?
You're in trouble.
In what way?
Discipline was so strict. If you were caught out and you weren't there, you were sent back to the battalion in disgrace. And you'll see you'll know about it.
And that would just be because you couldn't get out on parade at 5 o'clock. You couldn't get out of bed.
No. It was just you disobeyed rules.
So what would you're in the barracks, and you know, if you did your parade, what were these fellas that didn't manage? Were they still lying in bed drunk from the night before?
No, everybody was up. Discipline was very strict.
So how would you fail at 5 o'clock in the morning? How would these men
fail? Absolutely, you were there on parade.
Yes,
and in no time at all. And these were snap parades, catch you up.
But how would these men be failed? What would they have done wrong?
Well, discipline was very strict, and we had to, although we were a senior NCO in Catterick, we went there on holiday. And as I said, the management was damn strict as well. I mean, it all depended, when you face it, it was all dependent upon the colonel in charge of the school and his wife and the senior one officer. They weren't there wasting their time. They weren't there going to be messed about by these tasks more than the instructions. You had to be spot on, otherwise you were sent back to the battalion.
Yes, but what would you have done? What could you have done wrong that would get you sent back? What kind of fault would they have?
Not being on parade for a start, not being answering the roll call. If you were absent and you couldn't, and you were discovered as not back.
You mean a man could have stopped overnight somewhere? That's what you're saying.
That's right. Met a woman in Darlington or something like that, and he thought he'd be back in time for the first grade at 8 a.m. Oh, he was called out. 5 a.m. roll call. If you weren't there, you were absent without leave, and you were sent back to the town.
So it was basically a way of catching out men that would want to stop overnight for reasons.
The only reason was like catching out those clever dicks who thought they could sort of fool the system. They were ruthless. And for the misdemeanor, you were sent back to the battalion as well.
So in that sense, Catterick was like a return to your early days as a recruit in terms of...
As an NCO, yes. As a senior NCO. Many of them, bearing in mind that many of them were still acting sergeants. Weren't war subjective, until you held the rank for 12 months. Acting sergeants, and you'd go back to your unit, you'd be a corporal again. You'd miss the chance.
And would you be at that stage? You would be acting sergeant as well. And would you be acting? Acting sergeant unpaid at this stage.
Well, first of all, it's acting unpaid sergeant. So you're unpaid as far as I can remember. For about 3 months, and then having passed 3 months, you're unpaid, and then you keep that rank for 1 year, and you're more substantive, and you can lose that. The brigadier. So really speaking, you were, and even officers had temporary appointments, and we didn't know that, but they were lieutenant, temporary captains, stroke captain, so they were all on probation as well, and on trial. It was like throughout the army, you had these temporary appointments there in the case of officers, and acting unpaid, and acting in the case of NCOs and war officers until they had to prove themselves overproven. So anyway, it was his best behavior. He didn't want to go back to the Shannon and lose his chance. You had to play it straight. It was a very... It's a very good school, and it was really disciplined in every way, and smartness as well.
So standards of turnout were just as high?
The standards of turnout were excellent. You had to show that you were worthy of being especially with the sample set by the guards, the chap that was in the first class, and this tall chap was a membership regiment. Everybody was immaculate. Glasses polished and shoes polished and everything. The sergeant's mess was wonderful. It was like a first class hotel. It was one of the food was great. But the discipline was there. And you as well had to be confident enough to go out and lecture to the class when called to do so on any subject.
Not just on signalling, on.
In hand, and also you are. You have to pass your drill course. There was drill and word of command. You had to pass command of giving orders. And you were tested on that and given marks for anything like that. So that you had to be